Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, and welcome to the Greylock Capital China under Xi Jinping conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Michael Reeves with Greylock Capital. Please go ahead.
Hey, everybody. Happy holidays. We're glad you're here. Thanks for the folks that are here in our conference room, and thanks for the folks that joined us over the conference call today. So this has been an experiment for us. This is the first one of these we've done, and we'd love to have your feedback when it's over. We're hoping to maybe try to, on a quarterly basis, have a different speaker in each quarter to kind of talk about something in emerging markets and topical that would sort of just give context to kind of what we do. Do you want to hear anything about Greylock today? Other than sort of the passing hello, and there's some couple of little fun overviews inside the books. So hopefully everybody got a copy of the book. For the folks that are joining us by conference call, we'll get you copies after the after the call. So the theme today is really around Xi Jinping, China's current premier, and kind of looking back or looking forward, and kind of what's the future, you know, the outlook for China. Our speaker today is very qualified to talk about it. It's Scott Tong. Who is the former and founding Shanghai Bureau Chief for NPR's Marketplace, which is a business show that I'm sure a lot of you have heard and listened to pretty regularly. And Scott's been reporting for NPR and Marketplace for some time. Currently is the correspondent on sustainability desk, so reporting on energy and world economy issues. So I assume you could probably take questions a little bit off the China grid if anything comes up. We actually got to know Scott when Hans and I heard a story that he did on Venezuela on NPR, and we thought, oh, that's interesting. He actually got it right, and Hans reached out, and that's been the relationship since. But we're glad you're here. Scott, if you can wait a few minutes after Scott finishes talking, he'll personalize the books for you. Anything else about your background? Georgetown grad, NPR for a number of years, lives in the D.C. suburbs, bikes to work.
That's great.
Kids, got a senior in high school.
Senior in high school, and that's good.
And the whole family was over in China with you while you were in Shanghai. Mm-hmm. So, all right, we'll go ahead and let you take it away.
Great. Thanks. Okay, well, listen, thank you all for coming here. Thank you to Michael and Hans and Greylock for hosting me here on this. You know, in the radio world, we're usually talking to an empty room. So it's nice to have human beings on the other side. When I first went into radio, one of my colleagues said, well, what you have to do is you have to talk into the microphone and imagine who's listening and imagine somebody on the other end who's interested in everything you say as if that person exists. So nice to talk to actual people and interact. And I'm happy to, if those of you in the room and perhaps on the call, if you want to raise your hand or kind of interrupt at any time, I'm happy to do that. So the book that you have a copy of is called A Village With My Name, and so it tries to take a long view of the Chinese economy and how it got here and told through the lives of five people across five generations of my family tree. I will not lead you chapter and verse through my family history here. It's not that interesting. But I'll tell you a little bit about that. What I take away from this book project is kind of a longer view on the Chinese economic story and what I learned, how it got here, and to frame a little differently for me as a reporter, as an economics reporter, where China is now and its challenges going forward. So I'm going to talk about kind of briefly this kind of longer history takeaway that I have here and why I think it matters. I'll talk about the Xi Jinping government now that's going into its second term under the Chinese system. I'll talk about kind of big economic opportunities and challenges going forward for the Chinese economy, for the government, for the people, for investors who are interested in China, and then open it up to your questions. I'm happy to talk a little bit about President Trump's trip to Asia recently or anything else you might be interested in. I should tell you, as Michael had mentioned, I've been away from some of the day-to-day granularity of the Chinese economy and numbers, and I've tried to actually take a little bit of distance, geographic distance and historical distance, to understand it a little bit better. But to the extent I can shed any light from reporting on this and living there for a number of years, I'm happy to share what I know. So a standard view, I think, of China. Well, let me ask you, how many people have been in China and seen some, a little bit or a lot of China? So, you know, maybe 40%, almost half of the room here has been there. My sense is the standard view from the outside, and those of us who kind of go in and either business persons or journalists who go into China, is this notion of instant China, that it is a right now story, kind of this Big Bang economic story that's happened in the course of a generation. And if you, as I do, you go to a place like Shanghai immediately, you get skyscraper syndrome. You kind of think that this is the story of China right now, that it's all kind of shiny and new, and the scale of China is tremendous. So it looks like it looks very impressive, and it's hard to contextualize how China kind of got here. And you stay for a little while, and you realize, you know, it's somewhat what it seems on the outside, but if you look at the skyscrapers, a lot of the skyscrapers aren't managed very well for a long time. Chinese buildings age very quickly. So kind of the software part of the Chinese economy is more challenging. You hear questions about the nature of the human capital and the workforce that's there, and the quality of the workforce, and some of those additional questions arise. So after a while, you develop a little more kind of complex view about what's happening there. I think the standard instant China view goes something like, it starts in the late 70s. So Mao Zedong, kind of the founder of communist China, dies in the late 70s. You know, after a generation of closing China's door to the world, right, and inflicting a lot of the horrors that you've heard about in China, and then in the late 70s, China's door to the world gradually opens again, and Deng Xiaoping comes along, and in a lot of ways, the government starts to get out of the way of people's lives, right? They allow farmers from the countryside to move to the cities where they're far more productive and incomes go up. They allow in foreign investment. China eventually becomes the factory to the world and the smokestack to the world. And it becomes this kind of emerging market story of our time. And so part of the story is the notion that the Chinese and the Chinese leaders, they kind of pull the right levers to execute what we're seeing now. And what I learned in writing the book is a lot of the roots to what's happening in China now are more global in nature, and in some cases American roots. That is, about a century ago, and my family has people who are kind of part of this Enlightenment generation in China. China came late to modernity, and my great-grandfather, you know, who was from this little village along the Grand Canal of China, which is, you know, I learned is the longest canal in the world, but it long became obsolete, like a lot of the canals in the United States. So he got out of this forlorn village in eastern China, and he went to Japan toward the end of the 19th century. So he was one of a lot of these outward-looking Chinese nationals, these kind of cultural middlemen who were connecting with these initial ideas from the outside. And at the time, for China to connect to the outside, the place to interact with that was Japan. Japan was, you know, had, as you know, started to open up and modernize in the 1860s. And so that is where these big ideas of industrial modernity started to interact with these Chinese nationalism. A lot of the isms, capitalism, social Darwinism, empiricism, feminism, science and technology, the rule of law, globalization, a lot of these began around then. And a lot of these ideas originated from Western Europe. Japan was kind of the conduit, and some of them came from the United States. The story of my grandmother, born, you know, kind of middle of nowhere China, is that in 1911, someone decided to unbound her feet and give her an education at the feet of American missionary women who moved to China in 1911. So a lot of the kind of the seeds of the China story, for a lot of economists, they kind of go back to there, you know, rather than kind of this instant Chinese story. In the case of my family, and this may be the last time I talk about that, is these Chinese nationals who are kind of outward looking. When Chinese economy is open, they're the opportunists. They have educational and other opportunities. And when China's doors close, they become the victims and the scapegoats and the traitors over time. And then when China reopened its doors, they became the opportunists again. And that's the story in my family, but in the story of a lot of Chinese families. So I try to tell this longer history through these kind of cultural middlemen in China. So big kind of takeaways from this historical look is, again, I think the China arrival story is a longer, more global story in origins. It is, to a certain degree, a Communist Party story, but not an entirely Communist Party story. There is a strong academic view that the Mao period was more of an interruption in a longer story of China opening up, rather than a kind of a defining moment of change. And I think, looking at it from a distance, it seems like less of a miracle story. It's easier to understand. China, like a lot of countries that you all follow, is a clear case study of globalization, comparative advantage, and that showing up in human welfare. If you go to China, you see how people's lives in cities like Shanghai, in the villages, are remarkably better than a generation ago. And the last big takeaway is there's always been this tension in China at the government level, at the regular person level, is how to be modern and Chinese at the same time. As China has, you know, tried and failed and tried and succeeded to modernize, this tension has always been, as some put it, you know, how do you open the window but not let in the flies? And this is at the center, I think, of the Xi Jinping regime. It certainly wants to modernize the economies. The growth is slowing, and he really is playing up the Chinese narrative that this is a kind of a moment for China and to bring the Chinese people together. The tension to that is the historical evidence is when China has opened up to outside ideas, capital, education, all of these things, the welfare of the Chinese people has improved. And so I think that's a tension we're going to see continually with the Chinese government and with the Chinese people. I will give you a couple kind of stats to catch us all up on where China is today. You know, since the 70s, it's average double-digit, you know, about 10% growth per year. Now, World Bank says it was down to 6.7% in 2016, and the projections are that it'll continue to stay in that range, the 6% range, according to the IMF. The savings rate is still really high, you know, about 45-46% of GDP, which is coming down. And the importance of that is China is going through this long, uneven transition to a consumption economy, to kind of move away from, pouring cement and building things and investment and moving to a service economy and a consumer economy. So as the savings rate comes down, the consumption part of the economy will continue to grow. GDP in 2016 was about $11 trillion, according to the World Bank. Population is at 1.37 billion people, which is going to peak and fall precipitously. So China is going to fall off a demographic cliff, both in numbers and the ratio of old people to young people. and that will be a big structural challenge that's built in.
Can you say what the peak is or what year that is?
I don't have it on me. I think maybe in the next 20 years or so, and even before that, India will surpass China in population, and then the Chinese population is going to peak and fall quite rapidly. So certainly is going to, as the demographers say, it's going to get old before it gets rich. You know, we'll have fewer young people. The ratio of retired people to young people is going to change dramatically, and so that will be different from Japan, right? Japan got rich before it got old, and China's not going to have that luxury. Income per capita is about $8,200, and the exchange rate, a matter of, you know, continuous conversation in Washington. It fluctuated. When I first got to China in 2006, one U.S. dollar bought 8 Chinese RMB. When I was there, the dollar's purchasing power went down, so the Chinese currency appreciated significantly. So my purchasing power and my paycheck in U.S. dollars went down when I was there. So by the time I left in 2010, one U.S. dollar bought about 6 RMB. And now it's back up to about 7. So it has gone up and down and up, and certainly, you know, not in a straight line and a more complicated story than you know, than the folks in Washington might lead us all to believe. President Xi Jinping is I'm sure you've, you know, read some of the coverage of his government, and at the latest Party Congress, the official word came that his second five-year term has begun. There have always been competing political camps in Beijing. Right now, Xi Jinping, his political standing is unrivaled in China. When I was there during the Hu Jintao regime, and certainly before I got there with Jiang Zemin, there were always competing factions. Not so much now. Xi Jinping has sidelined his key rivals in a very successful way. So his stature is, to many, on par with Mao's stature, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. So his name is enshrined in the Chinese constitution now. So the notion of, you know, him being the new strongman of China is one that a lot we're going to be asking and talking about, I think, for a number of years. Two terms, so a decade, though after that, as in the case with Deng Xiaoping, there's a possibility of the Chinese leader always kind of effectively, you know, controlling a lot of things from behind the scenes, less officially. Yeah, he wants to make China great again. It has some parallels with the U.S. discourse. You know, I mean, every country has a story it tells itself, right? The politicians sell it and the people buy it. And similar to American exceptionalism, I mean, he is talking up this long Chinese story of, it's almost Chinese exceptionalism and China's return to the world stage. The kind of received history in the textbooks is that, you know, China was kind of on par with, you know, Western Europe in as recently as the 1700s, which I think there's a lot of evidence for. And then there was a century or two of humiliation, of colonialism. That's how the story goes, and China is back or is coming back. And it's not just a story emanating from Beijing. If you go on the streets, I have a cousin who was raised in Shanghai. My father got out of China just as the communists came, and his brother didn't get out. And so this brother's son is my cousin. And he's one of these voices of Chinese nationalism, the strong nationalism. That's a real thing. It's not just a talking point for the government. You see it online, you hear it on the streets, this notion of China kind of returning to where it once was is an important one for the Chinese story. and we will hear it a lot more under President Xi Jinping. On its economic agenda is to have more balanced growth for China. It has been very unequal growth over the last couple decades. The Gini coefficient has grown significantly. Pollution, you've heard, is a significant problem. I mean, this is a place where kind of the social contract between the government and the people is ideologically, most people on the street will not tell you that they have much ideological alignment with socialist government. It is really, the government will create the conditions and claim credit for people's lives to get better, which they have, and in return, the people will kind of keep their heads down and not make noise. But the more you have issues that affect people on the ground, like this inequality, they see what life is in Beijing and Shanghai, and then they see what life is back in the village, and that's a problem. They see the pollution that is affecting the water and the air, and that is a problem with disenchantment. Another big part of Xi Jinping's agenda is the state-owned enterprises. China still has a lot of state-owned enterprises that are far less efficient than the private companies. Heavy industry, mining, manufacturing, aluminum, steel, cement, just some areas where these SOEs are a big drag on growth. So reforming them, promoting mergers and acquisitions, is something that most economists think has to happen for China to push on growth. Xi Jinping has also, explicitly talked about cracking down on nefarious kind of foreign ideas and foreign influence. There have been external and internal memos that have led to restrictions on foreign websites. And so these directives have been made clear to members of the party. A lot of people who've been watching China for some time say one of the high water marks for China's openness might have been 2007 or something. And there may have been some backsliding ever since then, you may remember kind of Tibet went up in flames, and that was seen as a stability issue, and a lot of the internet and political discourse was restricted then. In 2008, I was there for the Olympics, and that was this big pride moment for China, right, followed by the financial crisis here in the States. And so the Chinese felt much more emboldened in their own model, and as they perceived it, the success of the Chinese model, rather than following the Western model. So I did a bunch of interviews in the course of doing this book with some survivors of the labor camps, the Chinese gulag in the 50s. My maternal grandfather spent his last days there. And a number of them wanted to tell the story but didn't want to attach their names to it because they said under Xi Jinping, the situation has changed. The openness for people to talk about things that they might fear might get them in trouble. Whether that was true or not, but the perception, that openness was being compromised, is certainly there. And there is a lot of that sense now of people being more risk averse in the public discourse right now. Big economic questions going forward that I will be watching is the big phrase with the Chinese economic story is reform and opening. It's been 40 years now. Is reform and opening stalled? Is an important question. In economic terms, opening in the financial system to kind of foreign investors, life is very hard for international banks there. State-owned enterprise rationalization, open trade, environmental reform, it is a big challenge now, and the question is what happens to the openness. the aging population. China right around now is passing a point where their what's called their surplus labor of young people has is just about gone. So a lot of developing countries go through this demographically once, right, where they have a lot of young workers, and then they start to run out, producers relative to net consumers, or old people who are drawing down in society's resources. And that's happening now. So that will be a drain. You know, that those are economic headwinds that China will definitely be dealing with.
Is that mostly due to the one-child policy?
I think partly. My cousin there, he's an only child, and he was born in 79, right before the imposition of the one-child policy. A lot of demographers will say that even without the one-child policy, the birth rate was going down anyway. So there's an argument with a lot of evidence to it that if you look at China and other countries in similar state of development, that the birth rate might have gone down anyway. But so I think if you take both of those things into consideration, certainly this imbalance of young people to old people is starting to catch up to China now. Inequality is rising, as I mentioned, and a big part of the growth story in China the last decade and a half has been the housing boom. So my uncle described this to me. He was kind of given an apartment. He's a professor, but he couldn't own it. And then in the early 90s, right, the Chinese government reformed the housing market and allowed people to purchase housing, especially those who own their apartments at highly discounted rates relative to the market price. And so a big part of wealth creation and a big part of the growth story, a big part of the debt story, has been this housing boom. People owning property, purchasing additional property, a lot of building of that. And a lot of people think that is kind of played out, that a lot of the building more generally in China, they've kind of built what needs to be built now. So, what happens next? Because that engine is at the very least slowing down. Can China move up the innovation value chain is still a question out there. To be sure, in certain areas like solar panels and wind energy turbines, electric vehicles and batteries, we hear a lot about that. But it's clear that, right, the T-shirt making era of China ended before I got there in 2006, right? Those are already moving to the next cheaper place then. And so being able to make more valuable things and charge more money is something that is explicitly part of the Xi Jinping agenda. How well it will go is still in question. I mean, there's a Made in China 2025 plan for the Chinese to, have an entire domestic supply chain for key things like high-speed rail and other things. Whether that happens, whether the know-how is there, is an open question. And finally, I'll kind of stop after this, is this rebalancing of the Chinese economy from heavy investment and low in manufacturing to services and consumption. A lot of economists think that rebalance has been going on for 3 or 4 or 5 years now. We see that wages going up, and that leads to more consumer spending. We see retail numbers through the roof, so that part of the story of the Chinese story is still a great part of the Chinese story. But how to what degree that continues and how quickly that continues, that's kind of the next structural engine of China's growth is something that bears watching. And I'll also be watching, and then we can talk about this if it's interesting to you. What will likely be trade fights with the U.S. government. There's this kind of wonky part of trade law called Section 301, and those are some of the big trade fights that are kind of moving through the machine in Washington. And Section 301 is sanctions, trade walls, where the president has extraordinary latitude to impose restrictions on imports. And next year, I think that will be a significant question. You know, I'll stop there and ask for any questions you might have. So thanks very much.
Can you speak a little more to kind of choosing things, One Belt, One Road initiative?
Mm-hmm.
How you see that your kind of global reporting impacting, you know, actually China as an external actor, not just in the U.S., but really kind of Africa, South America, other emerging markets, emerging economies?
Sure, yeah. So One Belt, One Road is the product of some fantastically successful branding of a lot of things that have already been going on. When I moved there in 2006, there was already construction of pipelines and rail going to Central Asia. China was already investing significantly in infrastructure, ports in the Philippines. And so now, this kind of infrastructure diplomacy that China is engaging in now has, it's a continuation, but now it has a name. And it is an explicit attempt of the Chinese government to do a few things. One is to kind of take the domestic model of investment to do what the Chinese are really good at, to build things, build infrastructure, and to finance it. In parts of Southeast Asia, South Asia, all the way toward Europe. So it is an economic program. It is a program for the Chinese to develop alliances, allies, build relationships around the world. And in many cases, it's an explicit choice to kind of move around the, you know, kind of the U.S. umbrella in Asia. There's a sense in China that it if you look in different directions, it's kind of surrounded by countries that it's not sure are friendly to it, right? The U.S. and Australia and Japan. So it is India, an effort to build friendships and relationships around the world. And the Chinese have been obsessed with this idea of global soft power for more than a decade, ever since the term came out from, Joseph Nye at Harvard University, that, you know, trying to win friends around the world. So that this is definitely part of that. It will be a uniquely Chinese model of investing in parts of the world where you may have heard about this in Africa and other places, where the Chinese provide the labor, the Chinese provide the suppliers, the Chinese provide the capital. It is semi-transparent, you know, how all this, how all this goes and who the winners are. There will be challenges, I think. Certainly in Washington, the framing of this is, you know, the Chinese are kind of winning at the U.S. expense and are kind of taking over these parts of the global economy. From inside China, there's a lot of angst about how China is going to adjust to global norms. So in a number of countries, there have been labor strikes, and the Chinese are very it's very important for the Chinese to succeed in these places. And so they've had to be flexible, right, and to in many cases to kind of give in to these labor strikes. So it will be the investments won't necessarily be efficient. This will be a friction between kind of the Chinese domestic model, you know, for which there's not too much accountability, and going out into the world for which there's more accountability. So there's a lot of talk about the Chinese paying tuition, you know, kind of learning about global norms as part of this. When I first got to China, there was this phrase that so many talked about as far as outbound investments of encouraging companies to go out, to kind of walk out, because there was a sense that this would, you know, help help Chinese state-owned companies and private companies develop in ways that they weren't necessarily good at, right? To develop their global Rolodex, to develop global expertise and technology expertise, and to understand global norms. So I think this is something that the Chinese are really committed to, and there will be public goods that come out of it, roads and ports, and human welfare in a lot of these places is going to improve. I think there's also going to be some friction when China kind of encounters these things that will be new to Chinese companies who have been used to operating at home in certain ways that aren't necessarily going to fly around the world. I think we'll be hearing about this for quite a while. And it's again, I think it's brilliant the way it's been packaged. The Chinese aren't always very good at kind of branding themselves or their projects, but this is a good one.
Do you have any views on China's influence on North Korea and sort of how that relates to what the U.S. and China are trying to do in terms of the trade and everything like that?
It's been several years that I did a little bit of reporting along the North Korean border. And then when I got to the border, I heard all these stories about journalists who went in and didn't come out, so I didn't cross. Interestingly, at the duty-free shop to go across the border in the city of Dandong, they were selling, high-end things, for Chinese officials to bring in or whatever. And it underneath the glass counter with the watches was a bunch of Timex watches, next to Rolex and Omega and this other stuff. And they said, well, I have a Timex. Why? What is this doing here? And the woman behind the counter said, well, this is of great value, for the North Koreans. So what I took away from reporting there is the Chinese certainly know that they're the economic lifeline to North Korea. I mean, you can see the pipelines that are going in, right, providing energy to North Korea and the trade pipeline. And the Chinese government is clearly cognizant that they hold a lot of influence over North Korea and North Korean regime, because food and energy go in through some of these border cities. What I didn't know was the Chinese, so kind of global peace and stability are also priorities for the Chinese government, but there are other higher priorities that are more important to the Chinese. And one of them is, the Chinese government says, we live here. And if the North Korean state collapses, then a lot of unstable things can happen. And, there could be refugees streaming across the border. That part of northeast China that connects with the Korean Peninsula, there are already a lot of Koreans there, kind of North Koreans and others there. And if you have a lot of them streaming over, there could be the possibility of a lot of ethnic Koreans saying, well, this historically is ours. So suddenly you have the national borders in question, and stability and the idea of China staying together, I think is central to the Chinese government's to the Chinese people, to the Chinese government. Stability is, you hear a lot about stability first. And I think a country that has seen so much instability in just the last couple generations, what I came to appreciate is how important that is. Coming from a country like the U.S. where we're all about failing fast and creative destruction, I think in many cases the Chinese sensibility is different when it comes to potential instability. So my sense is, for the Chinese government that those, for the government to kind of stay in power and keep the national, keep the country together, as it were, keeping the regime in place. You know, those are higher priorities. Please.
We hear about the new focus on environmentally conscious growth, but what does that actually look like in practice?
It's uneven. So when I first got to China in 2006, there was an attempt to measure green growth. There was a statistic called green GDP that they were actually going to try to measure that growth, kind of minus the economic impacts of pollution. Didn't get off the ground because there was too much resistance from the provinces. There's a saying in China. I mean, when I got there, I had the sense that, you know, Beijing kind of ran the place, right? That a bunch of guys in suits in the Batcave were kind of controlling the whole place. And then I learned very quickly this phrase that the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. So there's this tension between the local officials and the provinces and the central government. I think the central government has been trying. They know how important it is, and has been trying to enforce pollution, pollution laws for a long time. But what it runs into is these local party officials, and they get promoted based on local GDP. So if you're a local official near an important lake with a bunch of paper mills surrounding the lake, your incentive to get promoted is to grow the local economy at any cost. So are you going to allow kind of an unlicensed mill or somebody to kind of cheat on their smokestack that's a little, not as tall as it should be? The incentive, it's a strong incentive to allow that to happen. And I think that dynamic is a challenging one for the central government. Now, the central government is really emboldened now under Xi Jinping. And certainly on climate issues, coal and electric vehicles, they've pushed a lot through. So I think this will be an important moment. But I think with pollution, it's as with a lot of kind of top-down things that the government has tried to do, rule of law, trying to crack down fake products, all of these things. I think pollution, similarly, is a challenge to execute at the local level. Yeah, please.
You hear a lot about ghost cities in China where no one lives there, and China's the next bubble, and banks that are bad loans. Can you comment on all that stuff?
Yeah, no, I guess the people I talk to who watch it closely, they say it is a concern, but it's not at the top of their concerns over what could happen with the Chinese economy. There is certainly have been overbuilding, overcapacity at the high end in apartment complex in these ghost cities. I think that's slowed down. You know, there's been a real estate credit. The central government imposed credit crunch on some of that, trying to slow that down and deleverage as far as the debt situation. The hard landing is one that at least the people who I think are closer there and the people I talk to often because I trust their judgment is, you know, one of those 15% possibilities for China. It certainly could happen, but at the same time, a lot of these kind of structural things that have brought growth haven't played out yet. This migration from rural China to the cities, right? What we had a century ago, that still has a ways to run as an engine of growth, right? This rebalancing toward the consumer economy still has a long way to run. So, will it? It's always a concern, But the more I kind of ask people about it, the more I think it is a they find it a low probability event, but one worth watching, I guess.
Okay.
Michael.
We were talking about the environmental initiatives and the incentives for the provincial government officials. Can you speak to kind of corruption? Obviously, Xi Jinping has cracked down on corruption, and that's been sort of a thing over time. Places like China and other emerging markets, how that's just kind of what you've seen with corruption or...
Yeah, no, I think it's important. So when I was in Shanghai, our fax machine got a bunch of faxes every single morning where there was a receipt market where if you wanted to kind of doctor your invoices or doctor your expense reports and you needed official documentation of some kind of transaction, the offers came every day, right? That is, if you want a public document, you know, for, you know, a $1,000 transaction, you know, we'll charge you 1%, and then you can get, you know, you can cheat. And then the competing kind of, you know, receipt provider would say, well, you know, we'll sell it to you for 0.5%. Just as an example of some of it, it was just so out in the open of this one particular kind of corruption. You know, we talked about Macau earlier on, you know, how money from government officials kind of gets into Macau for them to use or something is always kind of this black box in China. So it's a big problem. And I think, as you know, economists think about corruption as a tax, right? It just kind of slows growth. And for an economy that, when I got there in 2007, the growth rate, the official growth rate was 14.2%. And when you go from 14% to about 6%, there's a lot less space. You know, when you grow at double-digit growth, where you can do a lot of bad lending and bridges to nowhere and corruption and all these things, and that covers a lot of sins. Now, when you're growing a lot more slowly, it's harder to do that. And Xi Jinping knows that, and he's cracking down in, there's another phrase in China that you, you kill the chicken to scare the monkeys. So to make examples out of people, to try to get at this corruption problem. So there have been a lot of intimidating cases, you know, of government, high-level government officials that are in jail now. So from an economic perspective, it's something that has to happen. From a rule of law perspective, it will be hard for those of us on the outside to watch.
The capital gate went up in December of last year. Is there any talk about the government relaxing that?
Sorry,
the export capital.
Right. They restricted outbound investments and acquisitions in certain areas, right, entertainment and sports and a lot of areas. So I don't know. I mean, that is I don't know if you guys connect with there's a great asset called the Rhodium Group here that kind of watches Chinese inbound and outbound investment. And a lot of those numbers, because of this central government policy kind of restricting these outbound investments, it really fell off for the second half of 2016 and started to come back. Some of that is trying to curb large investments that haven't panned out, and as part of the debt crunch, you know, to restrict some of the lending in the United States, right? There seems to be more U.S. scrutiny of Chinese investments in the U.S. So I don't know the answer to that, but that will bear watching, because you know, there were kind of explicit reasons that the central government gave to slow that down, and that. You know, I think came as a surprise because there was so much, you know, Chinese investment going around the world. I had to buy movie theater chains and all this, and now what happens next is, you know, is an important question. But so I don't know where it goes.
Yeah.
Operator, can you just ask the guests on the call if they have any questions?
Of course. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And again, that's star 1 to ask a question. There are no questions in the queue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
World order, right? Is there anything you're seeing as Cisco, as part of projecting out? Is there any sort of natural alignment that you kind of see looking out 5, 10, 15 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you see China line itself more with the ASEAN nations, or Russia, or Europe, or India, or the U.S.? Do you see China thinking about their opportunity set given kind of U.S. retrenchment and South America, not to be
Oh, right, yeah. No, a distant relative working on construction on an oil rig in Venezuela, right? And there's obviously the China-Venezuela story that you guys know very well. I think that, the U.S. investment has been a central part of the Chinese growth story since the 70s. I interviewed a guy who helped bring a Pepsi plant in. I think it was 1980 or so, and he kind of talked about how it was in a bunch of fields, and they had to replace their industrial boiler back then, and it was kind of the early age of the China story, and they had to buy a boiler from another kind of a mushroom processing plant or something, and they brought it in, and it said 1876. So from the beginning, U.S. investment, U.S. companies, and the Chinese know this, have been at the center. So for all the political rhetoric, if you kind of look at the money flows, certainly European, but also American investment has been at the center of that. So mutually dependent. And so now what happens with the trade story and whether there's a trade war, that could really affect U.S.-China relations. We know from our economic history that when you kind of raise a drawbridge, the countries are going to likely retaliate. So I think that's one question, is whether this important economic relationship changes between the U.S. and China in both directions. I think with One Belt and One Road, the Chinese are trying to, I think they will establish more relationships with other emerging economies in Southeast Asia and the Middle East and Africa. In other countries that may be at a similar state of development, you might talk about corruption, perhaps are at a similar state of rule of law. Those are in some ways, I think, alliances that might make some sense in a way. The Chinese and the Europeans are talking about a new, kind of trade alliance. And a lot of people on the retail side actually said in many instances, whether it's supermarkets in China or automobiles, that the Europeans came first in some sense that a lot of European multinational companies have succeeded where their American counterparts have had less success. VW and Carrefour, their grocery chain, and on and on. So Zara, with apparel. So I think the Chinese-Europe relationship is one that EU relationship is one that also bears watching. I think that at the person on the street level, regular Chinese people, they know how kind of important the American model is or the American aspiration is. And for many wealthy or middle-class Chinese people, that's what they want their children to come to the United States, right? So if my child, if I have the resources and the ability to send my child overseas for an education, you know, the U.S. is often still first on the list. So despite the kind of the politics, and we're going to, you know, we're going to hear the rhetoric, I think there's an underlying set of connections that are really important, and the question is what happens to those.
Another question? Scott, can I stay behind and personalize some books if people want to get their copies signed?
Great.
And we're here, as you hosted that bailout, Caitlin, I, AJ, Hans, and others. So thanks, guys.
Thanks, operator. We're all set.
Trust and confidence.
Thank you. Have a great day.